Learn the difference between bar food and pub grub as you grab a bite with your pint at a friendly neighborhood pub in Britain.
A lot of the food that was considered very old-fashioned and old hat has become à la mode again.
Coming up, Guides from England offer pub dining pointers for traditional British comfort food. Living like one of the locals is what Matt Kepnes aims for in his world travels. The author of How to Travel the World on $75 a Day knows that you don't have to go broke to enjoy life-changing experiences.
The people and destinations you're going to don't spend a ton of money a day living their local life.
And guides from the Netherlands help us go Dutch with an insider's view of Holland. They'll explain how Holland stands out from the rest of their country.
In the north, we're very direct, and in the south, they're softer.
Let's travel together for the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. The price spikes of inflation don't have to ruin your travel plans. In just a bit, Matt Kepnes updates his advice for budget travel to almost anywhere in the world and how you can make it average out to around $75 a day. And for further help on experiencing authentic travels overseas, guides from the Netherlands join us later in the hour to clue us in on how the provinces of North and South Holland are the heart of Europe's most densely populated, wealthiest, and best organized country. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves by getting a good meal of home-cooked, typical English comfort food when we're in England. Tour guides Liz Boardman and Deborah Hayburn join us now to explain how English food can actually be a highlight of your travels in Britain and how it's improved a lot over its reputation thanks to the kitchens of many a neighborhood pub. Liz and Deborah, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank Hello. You.
So, Elizabeth and Deborah, when we talk about food, for me in my travels, you've got all the famous galleries and the castles and the museums. But I think the pubs are great. It's part of what you want to see and not just see but experience when you're in Britain. And a big part of that is, of course, having a drink. But another part of that is eating. Now, you've got gastropubs that are doing all sorts of fancy French fusion cooking and so on. But you've also got really good treatment of the traditional dishes of a pub. And I understand that there's almost a renaissance of the classic pub dishes. And even if you guys who grew up on those are not interested in going out for your bangers and mash, an American who's always heard about that wants to go to England and know what their options are.
Well, there are bangers and mash, and there's bangers and mash.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's bangers and mash, which is just a pile of mashed potato with some very anemic-looking sausages put on top, covered in gravy. And then there is a beautifully spiced onion gravy. Underneath it, you've got a Lincolnshire sausage or a Cumberland sausage full of herbs and spices, really good pork, and your menu or your the chef will know exactly where that pork has come from.
Wow.
So it's important to know the source of your food.
This is gourmet bangers and mash.
This is gourmet bangers and mash.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Now, Elizabeth, Deborah just kind of really showcased bangers and mash.
I could see you dribbling.
I was getting a little bit aroused, I got to say. I would like it if you could describe with all of the same sensuality a different classic dish. What would it be?
That's a good one, actually. You know, you can't talk about traditional British food, pub food as well, unless we talk about fish and chips.
Yes.
Now, immediately your mind goes to maybe a soggy piece of fish that's got with some cold chips. Oh, no, we don't have that anymore, Rick. No, the chips for us, fries for you, but chips for us, they're going to be fresh. They're going to be crispy on the outside, triple fried.
Triple fried,
in beef dripping. I'm sorry for any vegetarians, but triple fried in beef dripping. They are crispy but lovely and light and gooey on the inside. They're delicious. That's just the chips.
And you have your choice of different kinds of white fish?
You would have a choice, but traditionally we would either go for cod or haddock.
Cod or haddock?
Yeah. Now, generally with cod and haddock, we would have that battered in some way.
Yeah.
But again, nothing soggy. This is light, crispy batter, and the cod in the haddock, as soon as you cut into it, it just falls open with lemon inside as well.
You're doing it.
It's delicious. Now, just that traditional dish.
Now, mushy peas, that's something that's classic.
Oh, mushy peas, yes. But mushy peas, again, some people make mushy peas better than others,
yeah.
I think.
No, this is true. If you go to a great place that's proud of its mushy peas, you want those mushy peas.
But I think a lot of people think a mushy pea is just a mashed up pea.
But it's a special pea just
for mushy peas.
What makes it special?
I'm not sure, but you can only make mushy peas with this particular variety of pea. Yes.
It's so great. Hey, something that a lot of people are curious about is a Sunday roast.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Tell me, Deborah, tell me about a Sunday roast.
Oh, well, I think the traditional one is probably roast beef with a Yorkshire pudding, roast potatoes, roast parsnips, cabbage, at least one other veg.
We have a lot of veg.
Oh, you like peas. You have to have peas.
So okay. This was just like a big Thanksgiving dinner almost, it sounds like.
Well, every Sunday.
Every Sunday.
We like to give Thanksgiving every Sunday if we can.
There you go. So we wait once a year. You have it every... I knew there was
every
a driving force behind the Sunday roast.
I think as well that we used to always... The Sunday dinner was always a special dinner.
Yeah.
Over the generations, my generation included, it's very rare for me to cook that now because it takes all morning on a Sunday.
Right.
Everyone loves it, but within half an hour, you're then clearing it all up. We all go to the pub.
Go to the corner pub? The pub that takes the food seriously.
You have to have one that really puts
that as a forte of theirs. Yeah. We're hearing how the comfort foods of England are often getting a culinary upgrade at many of Britain's neighborhood pubs right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guides are Deborah Hayburn, who specializes in custom tours of Southwest England from her home base in London, and Liz Boardman, who offers cultural immersion tours of England from her home base in nearby Bath. You'll find links to our guests in this week's show notes. It's on our website at ricksteves.com/radio. Now, one thing I love, and I would like to hear, Elizabeth, about meat pies and pies that are not covered with pastry because it's kind of, but I love it. I love a cottage pie. I love a shepherd's pie.
Yeah.
I love a steak and kidney pie. What should we know to order these casseroles or whatever you would call them?
They are always worth trying. The pies in pubs in particular are normally very good quality, but it will depend on what flavor you have as to how they present the pies. Now, you could go in and order a pastry pie, and that could be steak and ale, steak and Guinness.
So a pastry pie, meaning with the pastry over the top.
With the pastry over the top and often underneath, completely enclosed.
So it's like an apple pie with no apples and just meat.
Meat and a type of gravy.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily potato, Rick.
No, okay.
Not in the pie.
No, you'd have that as one of the accompaniments. And one of the very popular ones is a steak and ale pie or steak and Guinness.
Nice.
Or a chicken and vegetable pie, which is always traditional. Mm-hmm. That's really
nice. Or chicken and leek.
Chicken and leek is another popular one, isn't it? The other option is something like a cottage pie or a shepherd's pie.
Uh-huh.
And instead of using pastry, you'd have it in a pie pot, but it would actually be mashed potato on top.
I find that to be kind of comfort food.
It is. If you've gone for a lovely walk on a Sunday in the winter and you're really hungry, go for something like that. It's delicious.
This is so much fun to be learning about all this food. Yorkshire pudding. Deborah, what is a Yorkshire pudding? Because we hear that a lot.
A Yorkshire pudding is basically batter. But once again, we're back to the beef dripping. Because you make up a batter, like a pancake batter. And then you line it's like a muffin tin with beef dripping. And then you pour your batter in, you cook it in the oven, and it all puffs up. And today, we eat it as part of our roast dinner. Traditionally, it should be just with roast beef, but now it's with everything.
So a Sunday roast will usually have a Yorkshire pudding?
Yes, it will, yes.
Okay.
But it started off as poor man's food, as so many of these traditional dishes did.
Speaking of poor man's food, what's the sort of a basic, like there's cheese toasties, jacket potatoes, there's a lot of just pub bar food, we'd call it bar food.
Yeah, the bar food would be the more simple food.
Right.
Again, good quality, but just fairly basic for presentation as well as eating.
And that might be in a pub that is not a gastro pub.
Yes.
It's a pub, a drinking pub that has a few hot dishes.
Exactly that. Yeah,
there you can get off. What are things to look for in the area of bar food?
Well, I would be saying don't get put off by the names because you could have something called Toad in the Hole.
Toad in the Hole.
Toad in the Hole.
Tell me more.
You're not. The good news is it's not toads.
Oh, great.
But when Deborah was just describing a Yorkshire pudding to you, It is a Yorkshire pudding batter with cooked sausages poking out of the batter to make it look like a toad coming out of a hole.
There you go. There's the toad in the hole. Yeah. All right.
And actually, that's lovely. In fact, that's one of the best ways to eat Yorkshire pudding.
Yeah. What about something a little, you know, a more elegant way to get a simple meal might be a ploughman's lunch.
Yeah. Oh, yes. What is a ploughman's lunch?
What is a ploughman's lunch?
Basically, it's a deconstructed ham or cheese sandwich, basically.
Right.
So you've got the bread, you've got the ham or the cheese. Traditionally, it would have been cheese.
Yeah.
With some pickles on the side, maybe a little bit of salad, tomato.
It's a little bit, it's sort of strangely elegant in a pub surrounding to have a ploughman's lunch.
It is, actually. Got,
it's a little
it's
chutney sauce and so on.
Yes, that's
nice.
Right. Very popular these days again, isn't it?
Definitely.
A lot of the food that was considered very old-fashioned and old hat has become a la mode again now.
There you go. And Elizabeth, we got to finish our conversation just with a couple of words about a dessert. What dessert might you find in a pub?
Best part of the menu, but the dessert in the pub. Eton Mess is always very popular. Eton Mess, which is a meringue with whipped cream and strawberries all mashed in together. Just imagine a smashed pavlova. It was always a housewife's favourite. Because if you were doing a dinner party and the dessert went wrong, you just chuck it together as Eton Mess.
Eton Mess.
Eton Mess. M-E-S-S.
And what is the first word? Eat like
Eton. As in Eton College.
Oh, Eton College.
Yes.
It's like a food fight.
Yeah.
Basically, that's exactly what it looks like.
Eton College Mess. I love
exactly.
it because a lot of people, I know in any culture, get stressed out when their dessert doesn't look as pretty as it's supposed to look.
Smash it up together.
Smash it up, embrace it,
own
it.
That's right.
There you go.
The other big dessert that you find in pubs these days, another old-fashioned one, lemon posset. That's my favourite.
That is nice.
Or cream and lemon.
Oh.
Or we've always got spotted dick.
Excuse me?
I know. I'm sorry.
Okay, we got it. What is this? So
spotted dick is a suet pudding, and it's infused with sultanas and some juices as well.
Okay.
It's one of those dishes you'd eat it and it would go straight to your boots. You wouldn't be able to move afterwards, but it's absolutely delicious.
Do you know the term gut bomb?
I haven't heard of that, I can guess though.
A sweet and delicious gut bomb.
But we would have that.
I think it's not a gut bomb.
You have to have it with custard.
Yeah.
Oh, it's delicious.
Yeah. Well,
absolutely.
I think the English love to dribble that custard on almost
custard
any
over anything.
There you go. You know it's an English dessert. It's got custard
on
it.
It has to have custard.
What a delight to talk to both of you, Elizabeth Boardman and Deborah Hayburn. I really, really, really want to have a chance to eat all of this stuff with you guys in a pub in your hometowns in Britain, okay?
Over several days.
You can do it. Okay, well, thanks so much and best wishes with your tour guiding.
Thank you so much, Rick.
A pair of Dutch tour guides join us in just a bit with insider tips on two of their country's largest powerhouse provinces. They'll help us distinguish our north from our south in Holland, where you'll find the big cities and economic heart of the Netherlands. But first, Nomadic Matt is back to remind us how most of us are really not too poor to travel once you learn a few basic tricks for keeping costs in line. Matt Kepnes tells us what's in his updated guide for how to travel the world on $75 a day. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. As a seasoned traveler, blogger, and author, Matt Kepnes, better known as Nomadic Matt, knows the tricks to explore the world on a budget. He's felt the sting of rising prices, but that hasn't stopped him from continuing to travel the world, finding the best deals along the way. In his new book, How to Travel the World on $75 a Day, Matt shares the smart, practical tips that have helped many people to travel more for less money. From budget hacks to off-the-beaten-path adventures, he's got the latest tips for the frugal vagabond. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we talked, about 10 years ago, and you were talking $50 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's $75 a day. I suppose that's just inflation. But how else would you say travel has changed in the last decade? You know, let's say somebody was really good at traveling 10 years ago, and now they're going to hit the road again. What's different?
Yeah, you know, the resources that travelers use have greatly changed, especially post-pandemic. You know, a lot of companies went under, you know, including, you know, the Stillworld, SDA Travel. You know, they had been around since the 70s. So all those old companies that you might have used 10 years ago don't really exist anymore. And so what has really changed is the resources, as well as Facebook groups have become a very popular way for travelers to meet locals, as well as find free accommodation and activities. There's a host of new web apps for like translation, ride sharing. If you're camping and you're looking for parking, you'll find a lot of like parking apps that will help you where to put your van.
Yeah, it's a different world. What, review some of the companies that we relied on 10 or 20 years ago that are no longer here.
STA Travel. They were Student Travel Association. So they were a great resource if you were young or wanted round-the-world tickets. Backpacker discounts, you know, youth discount stuff, guides.
Is the ISIC card or what's the International Student Identity Card? Is that long gone?
That still exists. That still exists. They were a big seller of that card, but now you pretty much order it online and it gets mailed to you.
Is it still worth the trouble if you're a student?
Oh, it's very much worth the trouble. You know, it will save you a lot of money in museums around Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and parts of Asia.
Now, you talked about Facebook groups. When you said that, I thought about Cruise Critic, which is a TripAdvisor group, right, or something, on the cruise ships. And I was very impressed when I was researching my cruising book for the Mediterranean, what a community that creates. And people on a cruise ship that didn't know each other otherwise, they had their own meeting room, and it was the Cruise Critic crowd. Is that kind of what you're talking about with these Facebook groups?
Yeah, they are for any part of the travel industry. So if you're backpacking Southeast Asia, you can find a group specifically for that. There's women-centric groups like Girls Love Travel. There is ones where if you want to find someone to travel with, like find a travel buddy. And, you know, these are great resources, not only for finding people, but also getting information. You know, if you're going to a place and you're not sure what to do, these groups will help you find that information and connect with people they might know.
So that's a different source of travel advice. You know, I'm in all this guidebook kind of stuff, but this is an alternative to guidebooks. Do people rely on these Facebook groups just to, they're going to Portugal and they want to know what to do and how to do it? Is that the primary resource for a lot of people?
For travel information, they are not the primary resource. Nowadays, a lot of people get their information not only from guidebooks, but from blogs, as well as Instagram and TikTok. But these Facebook groups are really used more to meet people in the destinations they're going to.
Okay. Tell me more about the apps, Matt, because there's a lot of apps that can do fancy stuff, but once you get on the road, you don't really need that fancy stuff. What apps do you find really worth the trouble and have a practical worth?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a big app guy myself. I love Google Maps. You know, that really, you know, displays where you need to go, local transport information, and like restaurant stuff. And I like Google Translate for dire situations. I'm still old school in the sense that I like trying to communicate with people verbally and like, you know, play charades and just kind of figure it out. People want to help you if you give them a chance.
That's very interesting you say that because I think I'm probably twice as old as you, and I could have all the apps in the world to do my translating, but I've never really wished I had it. It's fun to connect with people, and we speak English, and you can generally figure it out or get somebody to help you right on the spot, and it does help, it gives you an excuse to connect with people.
Yeah, I basically use that app as a way, like if I'm in a store and I can't find someone, I need to like translate the words in front of me. But travel is about human connection, and trying to understand each other through language and nonverbal cues is part of the travel experience.
Okay, so Google Maps, that's an app that you find worthwhile. What's another app that changed your world?
I loved the Couchsurfing app. Now, Couchsurfing is paywall themselves. That was an app that let you connect with locals, kind of like what the Facebook groups do. Mm-hmm. But there's alternatives now. There's one for women travelers called Travel Ladies. And then there's a alternative called Be Welcome, which is just for all genders.
Now, these are couch surfing, which is a little more hardcore budget than Airbnb.
Yeah.
Because Airbnb kind of started kind of that way, but it just evolved into being not much less expensive than hotels, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Nowadays, you know, they still have the rooms feature where, you know, you can stay in somebody's spare bedroom, but it's not their main thing.
But couch surfing survives, and there are different versions of couch surfing for different people's whoever you are, what is your crowd.
Yeah.
So that would be very important if you're talking about hardcore budget travel.
Yes, yes, for sure. And then there are alternatives. And then if you're camping in a van, if you're taking a van, you're doing RV life, definitely look up a local app for parking. So whether you're doing RV life in New Zealand, Australia, US, Canada, there is an app that will tell you where you can park your camper van for free for pretty much every country in the world.
Matt Kapnis has taken a break from his travels to join us from his home in New York and tell us what's in the updated fourth edition of his book, How to Travel the World on $75 a Day. We talked with Matt on Travel with Rick Steves about 10 years ago when he wrote his backpacking memoir, 10 Years a Nomad, A Traveler's Journey Home. You can hear that again from a link with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So Matt, if you think about traveling the world, and your book is explicitly the world, in the last decade or so, have different regions and continents changed in their accessibility and the ease and the rewardingness of traveling there? Or are they all just in the same sort of, if you knew the world 10 years ago, is it the same world for travelers today?
Yeah, I think the big destinations are still the big destinations. You know, the backpackers and the budget travelers, they flock to Europe, Australia, New Zealand. Southeast Asia is an incredible region of the world to travel around, but that region has changed too. You know, Laos didn't have a train system before. Now it does. Cambodia is reviving their train system. And I think one region of the world that has gotten more popular, especially post-pandemic, is Mexico and Central America. That has become a lot more accessible as you have direct flights coming over from Australia and New Zealand and more flights from Europe. It used to be, if you went 10 years ago, the travelers that really traveled there, especially on a budget, would be older Americans, you know, maybe 40 plus. And I know 40 is not old. I'm over 40. But just, you know, in terms of like the backpacker age bracket. And nowadays, you just see more younger people go over there. As I think what has really changed is they're seeing social media and they're seeing blogs and they're seeing people there showcasing that it's not dangerous. It's not as unsafe as their parents are telling them, like, oh, you're going to go over there and be kidnapped by the cartels. They see present day real world examples that information is wrong. And then
so what is your take on that, Matt? Because that is interesting for a risk averse, older, wealthier American. You dream of the days when you were in India or, backpacking across Indonesia. And you wonder, is the world a harsher place now with a bigger gap between rich and poor and more high-tech dangers or more pitfalls? I mean, if you think about sub-Saharan Africa, if you think about South America, if you think about Pacific Rim, Indian subcontinent, the Stans, these kind of places. We all know New Zealand, Australia, Europe, that's pretty simple. Are there places in the world that are becoming less comfortable, or would you say it's still a welcoming world across the board if you just got a little bit of street savvy?
I would say it's still a welcoming world across the board. You know, we all are carrying very expensive electronics in our pocket, and we should be cognizant of that. You know, you wouldn't want to keep your iPhone out or have flashy jewelry around sub-Saharan Africa, South America, and other places around the world. But people are people, and you know, they are welcoming and friendly, and they want to show you the best their country has to offer. And my mom, you know, she's in her late 70s, and she's, you know, being a mother, always worries about me. And I remind her, you know, that here in the States, we have a level of gun violence that is not found elsewhere in the world. And so, like,
yeah,
that can happen here. And I also remind her that news travels at the speed of light these days, right? So she's heard about that earthquake in Thailand. She's like, oh, there's so many earthquakes around. I go, well, it's not that there's more earthquakes. We're just hearing about it more often.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Matt Kapnis, also known as Nomadic Matt. His book is Travel the World on $75 a Day. Travel cheaper, longer, and smarter. So Matt, how does that $75 a day break down? What does that actually mean?
So the $75 a day is what it would cost to travel the world in a long trip. So that sort of breaks down into transportation, accommodation, food over a long period of time, assuming that you're going to go to affordable destinations like, say, Thailand or India, and then go to expensive destinations like, say, France or the UK, it kind of averages out. But what I really wanted to get across to people is that there are many ways to travel the world on a budget. You know, I like to say, travel like you live, right? The people in destinations you're going to don't spend a ton of money a day living their local life. And so if you kind of emulate your local habits, going to the supermarket, going to local food markets, taking public transportation, walking into the tourist office and saying, hey, what museums are free this week or what festivals are going on? You're going to find the affordable activities that will fill up your day and inexpensive meals and all the things that you do at home that other people are doing the destinations you're going to, but are not costing an arm and a leg.
So the big item in that $75 a day, I would think, is accommodations. I understand that even a youth hostel bed in Europe costs $40 now. What's your take on rock-bottom budget accommodations for adult travelers?
Accommodation is sort of the immovable object of it all, right? You know, it is very hard in some destinations to cut costs. You know, if you're going to Paris, you're going to find hostel dorm rooms, you know, $50 a night. And so, you know, if you're really looking for deals, you can try these couch surfing apps that we've talked about, these home swapping apps. There's a website called Trusted House Sitters where you can watch someone's apartment or house while they're away. You can use a website like Home Exchange, which, you know, you can go to someone's home and they could go to your home. And then you can also use credit card points for hotels. And then there's lots of sort of online coupon websites. There's one called Rakuten, R-A-K-U-T-E-N. And they often offer 10% off hotels.com, booking.com. So that can sort of give you an extra savings.
You know, in your book, you talk about booking a hotel smartly, assuming you're going to be booking it through a booking site. What's your advice in that regard? Because, you know, hotels pay 20% to have you book it through booking.com. If you're going to give them $200 when you book it, they get $160 and booking.com gets $40, roughly. Do you have any way around that where you can pay the net price by going directly to the hotel, or what's your advice?
Yeah, you know, I'm a former hostel owner, so I know all about the booking fees of these large websites. So I would say if you find a place, see if you can find their website and try to book directly with them. For large global chains like Hilton, Hyatt, Marriott, they will match any price you find. And some of these really rock bottom deals you find, they're usually like travel agent deals. And so you might not be able to get that price. You might have to book on a third party website. But if you can, go direct, because accommodation owners, they don't want to pay the extra 20%. And they...
It's still a lot of money, but you might as well get a direct price instead of the padded price because you wanted the convenience of going to a booking agency.
Yeah.
You just put in a needless middleman, in other words.
Yeah.
Another big element of your $75 a day is transportation. And, of course, renting a car or taking the train is going to cost you. In Europe, they've got this amazing bus network. What is it? FlixBus. And they've also got ride-sharing options. Do you know FlixBus?
Yeah, I love FlixBus. We talk about it a lot in the book. I use them all the time. They're sort of the Greyhound of Europe. They're in many, many countries, and they offer really comfortable buses. They're actually nicer than Greyhound. They're comfy. There's free Wi-Fi. You know, there's toilets.
And they're cheap. It's like $20 to go all the way across Germany or something.
Yeah, they're super affordable. For like a 3 to 4 hour ride, I will take the bus over the train. I mean, I love train travel around Europe, but you know, you just can't beat FlixBus on price.
Right. And is there still ride share options that are almost like just sharing a ride and helping pay for the gas?
Yeah. So the big one in Europe is called BlaBlaCar, BlaBlaCar. And that's all over Europe. And then there's other ones in Australia. There's ones in New Zealand. And there's not really many in the US or Canada.
You know, when we're talking about traveling the world on $75 a day, some people are like ready to retire and they're thinking, doing the arithmetic, can I do this? You talk about the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. What's the latest on that?
The FIRE movement is young people trying to work and retire by like 40 and then never have to work again. And so they move to inexpensive countries. They work all the time and they sort of live miserly to get as much money as possible. I'm not a huge fan of the movement. I think, you know, they're sacrificing short term.
Oh, so they're just tying. They're just, I'm in a rich country. I'm going to earn everything I can, pedal to the metal all the time, be totally out of balance. And then when I'm 40 years old or whatever, I can then take that, the fruits of all that ridiculous labor, and go to a cheap country and live out my life comfortably without working, retiring early.
Yeah, and then they travel and such. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, you're trading your good years for maybe future good years.
And you can also, you're maybe discounting, if you're that aggressive, you're discounting the fact that you could have a first world job with first world pay living in a developing world environment and live quite well and save a lot of money just by being a digital nomad.
Yeah, you know, the rise of remote work and digital nomadism post-COVID really just makes it easier to travel and keep your job, you know. And many countries around the world now offer digital nomad visas.
Hmm. And if the downside I hear is you just got to accommodate the fact that you're in a different time zone. So your 9 to 5 might be 3 to midnight.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it might be midnight to 7 a.m.
This is so interesting, Matt. Thanks so much for joining us. Again, if people want to learn more about what you're doing, your website's nomadicmatt.com. The book is How to Travel the World in $75 a Day. You know, in this business that you and I are both in, I hear a lot of people throwing around different quotes, and I like travelers' quotes. What's your favorite traveler's quote?
You know, I know this is so basic, but I do love the quote attributed to St. Augustine, that the world is a book and he who doesn't travel only reads one page. Because for me, the world is not a book, it's a puzzle. And the more you travel, the more you put together all the pieces of it, the more you understand the world.
Bravo. That's very good. You're building on St. Augustine.
Not many people can.
Not many people can. Well, that's Nomadic Matt. Thanks a lot, Matt, and happy travels.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Kapnis lists his favorite places to visit at nomadicmatt.com. An insider's view of Holland, that's next on Travel with Rick Steves. It's impressive how much the Dutch have been able to do with a small amount of land and with so much of it below sea level. And as Europe's most densely populated nation, I sometimes think that the thrifty and efficient people of the Netherlands don't always know quite what to do with the proud individualism displayed by some Americans. So to help us get a taste of how their own society is organized, I've invited two Dutch tour guides to join us today on Travel with Rick Steves to better understand their country from the inside out. We'll focus on the country's two most influential provinces of North and South Holland. They're where the biggest cities are. It also tends to dominate our view of the Netherlands ever since their golden age in the 17th century. We're joined now by Jody van Engelstorp from Haarlem near the sea, and Ellen Janzig, who guides tours from Amsterdam and lives in Den Bosch in the south of the country. Dank u wel for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
So good to be able to straighten some things out for our traveling listeners. And Ellen, a lot of Americans, when they say Holland and they say the Netherlands, they don't really understand what's the difference.
See.
You know, Holland's not the same, is it? What is the story?
I'm so glad you're starting with this, Rick, because I'm from the Netherlands, but I'm not from Holland, because I'm from the south of the Netherlands, which is the nation state, and it consists of 11 different provinces. And in the west, you have two provinces named North Holland and South Holland. It's always been the most important region, with the most important towns and cities like Amsterdam, Rotterdam, The Hague. But it's not the state. It's
right.
Not the nation. So I am from the Netherlands, but not from Holland, whereas Jody is from Holland and from the Netherlands.
Okay, so if we say Holland, you're probably talking about what most Americans think the fairy tale image of Holland is, of the Netherlands is. But technically, the country is 3 or 4 times as big, and that includes lots more, and
exactly.
That would be called the Netherlands.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
For instance, the typical Holland landscape of the Polderland is in the west. But when you go further east or further south, you even get some hills.
Oh, you got some, not mountains, but hills.
Well, things we call hills,
yeah.
But it's no more than like
okay,
60 feet.
But the famous below sea level Netherlands is really Holland.
Exactly.
Now, Jody, the fairy tale image of a, you know, the little guy with his finger in the dike and wooden shoes and all of the stuff that you probably get very tired of as a person who lives there. But if you're thinking about everything that is so quintessentially Dutch, how would you relate that to Holland compared to Brabant, for instance, where Ellen lives?
I think a lot of people, when they think of typical Dutch stereotypes, a lot of it is from Holland, actually.
Yeah.
Like what Ellen was saying, the polar landscapes, the dikes, the windmills.
The cheese.
That's right. All of that. If you want to see windmills, you go to Holland. If you want to go to a cheese market town, you go to Holland.
Actually, we call people living in North Holland cheeseheads.
Cheeseheads?
Yes. I have a cheese hat myself. I don't fit any hat. That's what it is. And our king has a cheese hat.
Okay. Now the Netherlands, and Ellen, how many provinces are in the Netherlands?
12, actually. 12. I just said 11, but there's a new one added.
A new one added, okay. Yeah. Is that Flevoland?
Yes.
Ah, Flevoland. Yes. That was not just added. That's created.
I know it's created, but when I was growing up at school, it was 11.
11.
Yeah.
So Flevoland is a created land. It was, and I've seen it over the years from the Zuider Zee to cordoned off to bailed out to unusable land to fertile land with roads and communities, and it's all modern. People live in Flevoland who are older than the land they live on.
Yes, that's true.
It's a fascinating idea, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And that's totally modern.
Yeah, lots of people
Flevoland.
Live there.
Flevoland, okay. Now, I'm still wrestling with this Holland-Netherlands stuff. Holland is, there's two provinces, North and South. Can we refer to the area as Holland, like North and South together?
Yoda? Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what I want to do, is just refer to Holland and the rest. Ellen, you're down close to Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
How are the people different from Brabant, where you live, and way up in Holland?
The main difference is the heritage that we have in the south is mainly Catholic.
Ah, okay.
And in the north, it's Protestant.
Uh-huh.
For instance, an interesting thing to mention here is the town where I live, Den Bosch, in the south. In the 80-year war, when Protestants were fighting the Catholics in the south, they took the town of Den Bosch. The Protestants took the town. Uh-huh. When you get to Amsterdam and you're taught this event, they say it was the liberation of Den Bosch.
Right.
But we in the south, we call it the fall.
The fall, or the who's winning and who's losing. Yeah. Okay, so the south is more likely to be Catholic. The north is more likely to be Protestant. That has some sort of, apart from religious characteristics, you know, you've got different personalities. If you think of a Catholic country and a Protestant country. Jodi, how would you describe the, granted it's going to be stereotypes and so on, but how would you characterize the Protestant personality compared to the Catholic personality between the north and the south of the Netherlands?
So we are very stingy.
Stingy in the north. So we say frugal.
Frugal, yes, I'm sorry. We are very frugal.
So that's Protestant. So the Protestants are the cheapskates, and the Catholics would have the fancy...
The Burgundian way of living.
Burgundian way, the French way of living.
Okay. The good food.
What's the joke that people in Holland tell about each other about being cheapskates?
For instance, how was copper thread invented?
I know.
Yeah?
Two little boys fighting over a penny.
Very good.
And they stretched and stretched. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Ellen, can you tell me a joke about people who are very frugal in the north of Holland?
Oh, yeah. There are loads of them. But for instance, two taxis collided, 22 casualties. So everybody's sharing a cab because it's cheaper to do.
There you go.
Things like that. Yeah.
Two taxis collided. Newsflash.
22 casualties.
22 casualties. Yes. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about frugality in the north and extravagance in the south, the Protestant and the Catholic heritage of the Netherlands. And we're joined by two wonderful Dutch guides, Ellen Janzing and Jodi van Engelstorp. So how about the language? Is there a dialect in the north and the south, or is everybody speaking the same?
No, yeah, we do have dialects. We have in the north like a harder sound. Like I speak the really hard, like that throat.
Uh-huh.
And in the south, they're way softer. And it also goes, I think, to go back to the cultural differences, is in the north, we're very direct. And in the south, they're softer. So we're hard, cold.
I think of Dutch people as frank.
Yeah.
We say frank. They don't fiddle around. They say it like it is.
Yes.
And they assume you would like to be talked to straight. And I've had friends in the north of Holland talk to me very frankly. And I just think, well, in some countries that would not be very polite, but I appreciate that. That's direct.
Yes.
That's Dutch. Yeah. That's the north. And in Brabant in the south?
Yeah, it would be different. Although we are properly Dutch, we're not Belgian. It's different again.
Because that is gradients, isn't it? You can go from Holland to Brabant to the Flanders.
Yeah, exactly.
And then to the Walloon. So
yeah, that's different again. But we are properly Dutch, so we tend to be frank and direct as well, but in a different way than they are in Holland. We take a bit more of a roundabout way of telling something.
Yeah.
Or we do not tell something directly sometimes.
Now, I had a guide in Holland, and I was stuck with him for 2 days because I would rent a car and I needed a guide for 2 days. And the conversation was not very easy between us. And I was awkward, so I kept trying to make conversation. And after a while, he said, Rick, it's okay. You don't need to make conversation. He said, silence is okay. So just stop struggling with this. I thought that was very frank. I kind of liked it.
Yeah. It's often mistaken for rudeness.
Yeah, it can
be. People can think of Dutch people as being rude, whereas there's no rudeness intended. Well, sometimes there is, but usually there isn't.
And this is a reminder to Americans not to judge it because it's a different culture, different norms, and it's most likely a misunderstanding on your part culturally because people, I assume, positive intent. Yodi, you mentioned that the dialect in the north is a little more guttural. I'd like to just have a sound experiment. There's a famous tongue twister, I think, in Dutch, in your language. I'd like to hear you say the tongue twister, and then we'll listen to Ellen say it. First of all, tell me what it means in English, and then say it in Dutch, and then we'll hear Ellen say it with a southern accent.
Okay, so the tongue twister is 88 amazingly beautiful canals in Den Haag.
Okay, so wait a minute. 88 amazingly beautiful canals in The Hague. That's a city in Holland.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think I'll go with Ellen first because, do you know the tongue twisters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to hear it in the softer southern dialect and then we'll go to the north. Okay.
I'll put on my softest, soft G.
Okay, okay.
Okay. 88 allemachtig prachtige grachten in Den Haag.
Oh, baby, that was soft.
Yeah, it was soft.
Okay, let's hear it in the north dialect.
88 allemachtige prachtige grachten in Den Haag.
The funny thing about traveling in the Netherlands, everybody speaks English. I think it's almost fair to say everybody speaks English. So the tourist can get by without ever learning a word of Dutch. And that's kind of a pity. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now I want to talk about the landscape in Holland because, Jody, I would like to imagine it before the people came. Because when you're out on the dunes, you can feel this wild nature.
Yes.
Tell us about how we can find that and what it feels like or what it might have been like before there was people there.
Well, you can go to the dunes. You could rent a bike, for instance, and cycle through the dunes. The dunes is the higher landscape, though, and just experience the nature. Or you can go to the Waddeneilanden further north, and it's one of the islands is Texel.
Oh, Texel.
Texel, yeah.
Okay, T-E-X-E-L.
Yes.
Okay. This has always intrigued me, the island of Texel. What's that like?
It's the biggest island we have, and you can take a ferry there. It's just like a half an hour ferry from Den Hoorn.
Uh-huh.
And then there, it's all dikes. Basically, the whole island has dikes around it, and you can cycle over the dikes, and then they have all these tiny, cute little villages where, you can really feel the old fishermen feel and lots of birds. A lot of people come there for watching birds because it's a nature
preserve.
That stretches till Denmark, actually.
Because I've heard of the Vaden, W-A-D-D-E-N, the Vaden Sea.
Yeah.
And is that that's a similar area with high biological diversity?
Exactly. So if you're a birder, you need to go there. They have all, but mostly it's just to feel. They still have these cute little towns with markets and.
I love that.
Yeah, it's cute.
Cute little towns that had a fishing heritage and a salty heritage from a long time ago. And now a lot of the land has been reclaimed. Do you know the town called Schokland?
Yes. Yes.
Tell me, Ellen, about Schokland.
It's actually now, it's an island on dry land.
Yeah.
It used to be an island in the Southern Sea, which was an inlet from the North Sea. But it's been closed off by a big dike. And now it's created a freshwater lake, a big freshwater lake. And Schokland was a little island in the Southern Sea, but now they've sort of created the Flevoland around it. And the island's still there.
You can see the seawall around this little remote island. And today, the sea is long gone. The seabed has turned into fertile farmland. They've dragged away the old airplanes that crashed in the war that were just rusted heaps there when they drained out the land.
Yep. Yep.
And you've got yourself this time capsule island
yep.
that's no longer an island.
And you can actually see on the landscape that it's old land as opposed to the new land.
And everything we're talking about is within a couple hours at the most from Amsterdam yep. or Haarlem. Our guides to North and South Holland are Ellen Jansing and Jody Engelsdorp. Ellen majored in English literature, so in addition to tour guiding in the Netherlands, she also leads custom tours in Britain and Ireland and works as a translator and Dutch language teacher. Jody is based in Haarlem and has a presence on Instagram. You'll find links to our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. A lot of people are inspired to learn more about the Dutch battle with the sea. When they travel around and they see these dikes and they see this, the windmills and the modern windmills and the polderland. The polderland, that just means land reclaimed from the sea, right?
Well, below sea level. It's drained land.
Drained land.
Yeah, it used to be peaty swamps.
Yeah.
And then actually what a polder is a piece of land surrounded by a dike, a levee,
uh-huh.
where the water level is maintained artificially. So it's swampland that's where the moisture has been drained out of it to uh-huh. create dry land. The thing about it is, as soon as you drain peaty swamps and it's dry, because you take the moisture out of it, it sinks. And then it floods again.
Then it floods, so you have to have...
So you have to perpetually pump and
pump.
Regulate the water.
If you have a house sitting below a water table, you'll have a pump yep. in your basement to yep. keep it dry.
Yep.
And it's the same sort of thing.
So the pumps are pumping 24/7
wow.
and the land is still sinking. So what? Not only is the sea there next to it rising, but the land is actually sinking.
If you want to learn more about that, there are great centers where we can learn about the dikes. There's one in the Vaden area, I think. Do you know which one that is?
About the offshore dike, you mean?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That's the big dike that
explain
was closing
to us,
off the southern
explain
sea.
Explain to us the technology there and what we could, if we're a curious tourist that's interested in engineering and so on,
oh,
what
dear,
could we see?
There's so much because every situation in the Netherlands has a sort of unique quality to it. So you cannot have one solution that you just roll out for the whole country. You have to have a different solution at every spot. So there are in the southwest, there are different solutions to keep out the sea, which is called the Delta Works.
Uh-huh.
You have huge engineering constructions there. But the closure dike, the Afsluit dike is another one. And that is a proper dike, like a dam, that really is an obstruction to the sea. But nowadays they move more with the ecosystem and they have flexible ways of keeping the sea out. So not like the Afsluit dike was anymore.
Because is there discussion in the Netherlands about the threat of rising sea level?
Oh, yes, yes.
It must be on everybody's mind. And
yeah.
you're very frugal in the north. It's
yeah.
expensive to deal with this, but you're investing in your own safety in the future. Tell me about, because I saw a ship out at sea outside of a dike in the north. And there was a big geyser of mud, and it was moving mud. And then I saw tractors on the beach next to the dike moving sand, mountains of sand.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is really expensive, and the Dutch will not waste, you know, millions and millions of euros unless there's a reason for it.
But that's a good example. It's called the sand engine.
Yeah.
And it's a good example of trying to keep us safe from the sea by working with the sea, no longer against the sea, but working with it. So what they do is deposit lots of sand onto the beaches
yeah.
to make the beaches wider
uh-huh.
so that the sea has actually more space before it comes to the land. So it's it will grow organically, naturally as well. So it's a very natural solution to create another structure to keep us safe.
And are the Dutch people confident that you'll still have a country in 50 years?
Yeah, I think we are one of the safer countries. That may be, I don't know.
Because, you're investing in it and you recognize,
yeah.
and you've done it for centuries already.
Yeah, and we did a calculation that we wouldn't flood again in the next 10,000 years.
Oh.
And now, of course, we have to adjust because of all of the environmental changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're very creative. And yeah, we always used to see ourselves as kind of enemies of the sea. But now, like what Ellen was saying, we're really trying to work with the water now. So
yeah.
now we call it water management. When the water comes inland, so if we have a risk of flooding, old farmland, we make it available for flooding.
I see. Because
so,
that's the,
yeah.
you know, a lot of American communities, they flood and they're upset. But what they did was they cheated nature. They took land that was supposed to be there for absorbing the extra water. And your society is realistic or savvy enough to know that the best way to control nature is
yeah.
to obey it.
But we're the only country in the world where we pay water tax. So we pay separate taxes for the water management in the country.
Oh, I, you know, when you go to the Netherlands, you can learn a lot more about this. Well, what a delight to be able to get a good dose of what's going on in Holland and the Netherlands. And now we know the difference. Ellen Janzing and Jody van Engelsdorp, dank u wel.
Alsjeblieft.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Season 13 of my TV series Rick Steves Europe is now out. And this and every season of public television's most watched and longest-running travel series is available in its entirety, free and ad-free, at ricksteves.com. That's our entire library of episodes, cutting Europe into more than 100 slices, ranging from Iceland to Portugal to Turkey. Let's say you're wondering where to go in Scotland. Well, three episodes answer that question in 90 minutes. You can also read the full script for each show and find links to the places we visit. Sure, our TV shows entertain, but they're also practical guides to the smartest possible itineraries, turning your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. It's all at ricksteves.com.